But look what happens next. It's great. And no, it's better than great. It's unfathomable, unsearchable, immortal. Look, the king can't sleep. During that night, the king could not sleep. So he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Esther chapter 6, verse 1. While Haman and his gang are constructing gigantic gallows, Ahasuerus struggles with insomnia. So he orders one of his servants, bring the chronicles, bring the records, read them to me. How ironic. The same night Haman was building gallows to hang Mordecai, Ahasuerus was listening to the history of what had happened in his kingdom during the past few years, possibly hoping the monotonous reading would put him to sleep. And it was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Esther chapter 6, verse 2. When the king heard that, his mind was jerked abruptly from his desired slumber. He had overlooked Mordecai's uncovering the conspiracy against him. Aha, here's where that bit of unimportant trivia comes in. He had forgotten that Mordecai had literally saved his neck. And the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." Esther chapter 6, verse 3. Talk about a bizarre situation. Haman is out there building a gallows so he can kill Mordecai, and meanwhile, in the palace, in the middle of the night, the king is trying to find a way to honor Mordecai. What irony. Poetic justice at its best. "What has been done to honor this man Mordecai for what he did for me?" asks Ahasuerus. "Nothing," say his servants. "Well, we've got to remedy that," snaps the king. "Who's in the court?" By now, it's probably early morning, and there aren't many people stirring yet, at least not in the courtroom. But the servants check, and lo and behold, guess who's available? Haman. He's been up all night building the gallows, and he's anxious to have an audience with the king so he can further his plan to execute Mordecai. Talk about providential timing. I love it. So the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. And the king's servants said to him, "Behold, Haman is standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king desire to honor more than me?" Esther chapter 6, verses 4 through 6. Haman is so enamored of his own ego that he can see only himself. He's so puffed up with pride that he's about to explode. Surely the king could only be talking about him. He's the one the king wants to honor. Mentally, he's rubbing his hands together. Oh boy, now I'm going to get what's coming to me. Oh boy, is he ever. And he begins to list all the marvelous things that the king should do for such a person. Then Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array that man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" Esther chapter 6, verses 7 through 9. The king said, "Good idea." You're smiling. I am too. Then the king said to Haman, "Take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said." Esther chapter 6, verse 10. You see, when God calls the shots, nobody can stop the action. The most powerful man in the land next to the king gets his hands tied and his mouth silenced. God and God alone can do such things. Haman cannot believe what has just happened. He has no option but to do what the king has ordered. But when he gets home, he throws a fit. And Haman recounted to Zeresh his wife and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh his wife said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." Esther chapter 6, verse 13. Don't you love the counsel Haman's wife unloads on him? In other words, "Don't get your hopes up, baby. You're on your way out of here." Another Swindoll paraphrase. And that's exactly what happened. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Esther chapter 7, verse 10. As Shakespeare once wrote, "Hoist with his own petard," which is, of course, is precisely what happened to Haman. Why? Because of God and God alone. Suddenly, the old hymn takes on new meaning. Immortal, invisible, God only wise. In light inaccessible, hid from our eyes. Most blessed, most glorious, the Ancient of Days. Almighty, victorious, thy great name we praise. The inescapable message. When I come to this book that never mentions God, I see him all the more profoundly and eloquently portrayed throughout it. It's there in invisible ink. Just like life, I've never seen skywriting that says, "I'm here, Chuck, you can count on me." I've never heard an audible voice in the middle of the night reassuring me, "I'm here, my son." But by faith, I see him, and inaudibly, I hear him on a regular basis. Reading him written in the events of my life, whether it be the crushing blows that drive me to my knees or the joyous triumphs that send my heart winging. When I pause long enough to look back, I realize it is the unsearchable mind, the unfathomable will, the sovereign control, the irresistible providence of God at work, because he, though invisible, remains invincible. Responding to the quiet promptings of God. My point here is not merely to teach you a story from ancient Persia history, or to add the name of Ahasuerus to all those historical kings you had to memorize in school. I don't care about all that. What I do care about is that you see the relationship of the truths communicated in the story of Esther to the everyday reality of your own life. One way to do this is to realize that the gallows you think are prepared for you are not that at all. What might those looming gallows be? Some horrible pain? Some threat of illness or need for surgery? Some emotional stress that is leading to what appears to be your emotional demise? Some fractured relationship that you cannot repair or get beyond? Some sudden loss that leaves you gripped in grief? Some uncertainty concerning your career? A financial catastrophe? Or, worse of all, a spiritual vacuum that threatens your very soul? I have great news. Be still. Deliberately pause and discover that God is God. Stop reaching back into your own treasure of security. Stop trying to pull the strings yourself. Stop manipulating people and situations. Stop making excuses for your irresponsibilities. Stop ignoring reality. Stop rationalizing your way through life. Stop all that. How? You ask. Initially, be quiet. The immortal, invisible, all-wise God, hid from your eyes, is at work. Be very still and, for a change, listen. Ultimately, be convinced. Say to the Lord God, "I am convinced that you are at work amid the gallows of my life. I can see them in the dawn of the morning sunrise, but I know you're at work. I cannot change the events, but I know you are there in the midst of them. Rescue me. I come to you through Christ. I come to you alone. I am quiet. And finally, I am convinced. James Hastings captures the essence of the Book of Esther in these words. The Book of Esther does not say much about God, but his presence broods over it all and is the real spring that moves the movers that are seen. Centuries after Esther lived, and years before James Hastings was born, there lived a man named William Cowper. At the young age of 32, wracked by depression and despair, Cowper decided finally to take matters into his own hands and kill himself. He hired a carriage to take him to the Thames River. The carriage driver, a total stranger, seeing what the desperate young man intended, grabbed him and kept him from jumping into the swift current of the broad tidal river. Back alone in his own home, Cowper took poison. Someone found him in time to provide the necessary antidote. That night, he took a knife and fell on it, and would you believe, the blade broke? Early the next morning, he hung himself. But a neighbor, concerned about Cowper, found him and cut him down before he died, because of the unfathomable, unsearchable, inscrutable power of God, invisible though it was, William Cowper was unable to take matters in his own hands. He couldn't even take his own life. Suffering from acute depression and mental distress, verging on insanity, he turned increasingly to Christ and Christ alone for consolation. Later, he struck up a friendship with the great John Newton. Eventually, the two of them collaborated on a publication called The Only Hymns, in which Newton released his best-loved hymn, Amazing Grace. 13 years after his attempts at suicide, Cowper himself began writing hymns. Ultimately, he wrote 67 of the hymns in that work, including this familiar one. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable minds of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. We'll observe that smiling face through every twist and turn of Esther's life.